So today we are doing chapter number 18 in this book called What is Culture? Now people have different ideas or meanings of what is culture. But the word culture comes from the French word colère, which means to grow, to cultivate, to expand. So culture is the sum total of all the knowledge that we have. That's one aspect of culture. Not only spiritual knowledge, but scientific knowledge, knowledge of art, knowledge of music, mathematics, the knowledge of the world, who is what, different countries, different cultures in the Asia, in Middle East, in Africa, in South America, in Europe. The culture is different. So knowledge about how different people behave and how different people interact and how my culture, or my community, where I grow up, where I live, how do they, what is the knowledge and what is the source of knowledge is the books, or nowadays the internet. And then that knowledge translates into behavior. So different people of the world behave differently, how they meet each other. For example, in the East, in India, if you meet each other, now it's changing, but generally it was pranam, you know, I bow down to the Lord in you. But in certain cultures, they shake hands when they meet instead of doing pranam. Or in certain cultures, they kiss the person on the cheek. Now, if you did that in India to a girl you met for the first time, it would be considered highly inappropriate, probably get you beaten up. In some cultures, they kiss a woman's hand when they meet for the first time. So the behavior is unique to a particular group or a particular community. Not only how they behave, but the kind of food they eat, the kind of clothes they wear, the language they use. So everything is unique. And that is what is the meaning of culture. But culture is not something which is fixed. People say, oh, this is how, you know, Asians behave. This is how South Americans or Mexicans behave. This is how Europeans. And so we have this stereotype of this. This is how a person should be. But culture is a constant change of understanding, change of behavior as new ideas come. And also what we are finding now in the modern world is that there is an intermixing of cultures, especially in America. People from different parts of the world have met, they have mingled, they have married, they have had children. And so slowly the boundaries of division in the earth are slowly getting broken down. You know, with the internet you can instantly reach any part of the world, see what is happening. So there is a constant change in the culture, in the behavior. It could be for the good or it could be for the bad. I mean, but the fact is that life changes. You know, if you expect things to not change, then that is... So Swami Chinmayananda one place says, he says, change is the changeless law of nature. So the one changeless law is that everything changes. And everything represents culture, as I said, how we deal with our children, how we deal with our parents, how we deal with our neighbors, co-workers, how I walk, how I talk, how I conduct myself, how I do business, what are the ethics, what are the values, what are the morals, what is my religion teaching, what is my science, philosophy, the behavior. So as we had talked before, there are two aspects. One is religion and one is philosophy. Religion is the traditions, how we worship. Philosophy is the understanding behind the religion. So all that represents culture. And then in this chapter, Swamiji has talked a little bit about Western and Eastern culture. You may or may not agree with everything, but I'll just express what his understanding, and it seems to be very clear what he has said. So what he says is that the Western culture, because in Europe, the Western culture developed in Europe, and then from there they went to America, Australia, and all that. And then, of course, they conquered the world, the French, the British, the Spanish, and all. But the origin culture started in Europe, and in Europe the weather was very harsh, is very harsh. It's very cold in the winter. There's a few months of summer, and so people had to adapt to these harsh conditions, live in tough climates, and conquer nature, as it were. So the goal of Western culture or civilization is a constant conquering and overcoming and adversity and the ability to. Of course, things have changed now, but I mean that was the original premise. And then the Eastern culture, especially in this case, he represents or he talks about the culture in India, grew in a very gentle climate where most of the year, you know, it is good weather except for 2-3 months of summer or rain where it is hot and wet. It's very pleasant weather. The rivers were plentiful, the trees, the plants, the fruits. And our ancient Vedantic culture grew in that environment where nature was a friend. Nature was not something you had to conquer, you had to overcome, but you had to live with nature. So they grew up worshipping nature. They worshipped the sun god, moon, the fire, the air, the wind, the earth, the waters, the river, the ocean. So it was more, and that's why the Eastern culture is generally more peaceful, more peace-loving, more willing to adjust, to accommodate another's point of view. It's not anything good or bad, but that's how it was. Now things have changed. Now, we find in India, the population has increased so much and there is so much competition that it is becoming a very materialistic culture where what can I get out of it? And so, as I said, culture constantly changes. And in the West, we are finding that there is a revival of this ancient knowledge. People are, you know, listening to this, meditating, doing yoga, learning Vedanta. So there is the Eastern is becoming more materialistic and the Western is becoming more spiritual. So there is a constant intermingling of two cultures. Talking about the difference between the two cultures, I don't know how many of you have seen this movie or read this book, The Man Who Knew Infinity, or is familiar. If you have Netflix, watch it. Masterful movie, beautiful, or you can buy the book. So this is a story I'll spend some time talking about. A person who grew up in Tamil Nadu in South India called Srinivasa Ramanujan. And from childhood, he had these visions. He only went to studied high school. And in those days, high school was a lot because this was around 1900 or eight in the late 19th century, 1880, 1890. And so high school was a big deal, but and then he was working as a clerk and doing accounts. But from the childhood, he had visions of mathematic formulas and theorems would come.
I did watch that, yeah.
You watched that?
Yeah.
Mathematical theorems and formulas would just come to him. And he didn't know from where they came. His mother had worshipped the mother goddess when she conceived him. And so she believed that he was a gift from the mother goddess. And these phenomenal ideas would come to him. And he had no idea where they are coming from. He was channeling something higher. And then he sent these ideas to three different scholars in the West. And two said, this guy's a nut, you know, because they were so advanced. His mathematical theories, unbelievably advanced. But there was a Professor Hardy, who was a professor in Cambridge, and he invited him. He said, I'll pay your passage. And so he came by ship, came to England, and he studied at Cambridge under this. And then he would present his mathematical theories at, you know, meetings and wherever, assemblies, wherever they met. And people would laugh at him, and people would ridicule him, and people, there was a combination of, you know, that how can this guy have this advanced theories? And they asked him, where is the proof? And he had no proof. He said, I don't have any proofs. They just come to me. And they're like, this guy is a nut. And then there was some element of racism, because how can it such advanced thinking come from the East? Because that time the British were ruling, and so Indians were considered inferior, and his theories were so far advanced that even the greatest mathematicians of that time couldn't explain it. And slowly, as they started seeing it, they slowly started realizing that this guy is, you know, some kind of a genius, but very few people did. Ultimately, he was made a fellow of the Royal College in Cambridge, but still he did not get the recognition that he deserved. And ultimately he developed TB because he was not used to the cold climate, and he used to cook his own food because he was vegetarian, so, and he was poor, he didn't have much money. And so he developed a very advanced form of TB and then came back to his country and died. But the point is that the source of all knowledge is divine, is the Lord, is the consciousness. And to claim ownership of this is ridiculous, to think that I came up with it. In fact, the great masters who wrote the Upanishads, they never put their name. There is no title. Who wrote it? Who was the author? There is no ownership. There was no patent. There was nothing. Whatever. And what they said was that this knowledge I am God, I have got, is when they said they sat in meditation, they heard these verses. That's why it was called Shruti, or heard. And they heard these verses, which they then was so clearly visible to them that they could repeat it word by word to their students. And then the students memorized it and passed on to their students and so on. Ultimately, it was written by Ved Vyasji, you know, in script. So the source of knowledge, the source of culture is the higher, is the supreme, is the consciousness. And that is what this young man, this master taught us. He actually had a very unhappy life, because I'll just one brief incident. He had left his wife in India, and he had gone to England. And he would write letters periodically, but his mother intercepted the letters and never gave them to the wife, because she was afraid that if the wife gets the letters, she'll go to England to meet him. And so for years, she would not allow any, of course, they had no other method. And then so he would write these letters and he would get no reply, and he was so unhappy. And then she would think that my husband has gone abroad and abandoned me. So, but despite all this, his vision was so clear, and how these, it's a masterful. So the point is that the true meaning of culture is this divine knowledge. And it is the religious masters who, wherever they came, they brought a new meaning, a new idea. For example, Jesus, when he came to Bethlehem, and he found that people were practicing a very corrupt form of religion, where the priests would be there and you would have to buy your way into heaven. So if you made a donation, or if you gave money to the church or to the priest, you were guaranteed, okay, you go to heaven. And so the more money you got, the higher seat you would get in heaven. So all those, and then they did, you know, worship of idol is okay, but very wrong way of worshiping. And then the emperor was considered as God, and anybody who didn't worship him would be killed, and there were human sacrifices, animals. So he came and he said that this is wrong, and in my father's eyes, that nobody is, everybody is one. And they said, who gave you? He said, my father. And even when he was, and he spread this culture of peace and brotherhood, that love thy neighbor, and we are all one, and he tried to spread that, and he was so different, his teachings were to the establishment, that they killed him. They said, you know, let's get rid of this guy, because he's going to destroy our empire, you know, the Roman or the whatever the empire was at that time, the Byzantine Empire. And even when he was being crucified, he said, none of this would have happened if it was not permitted by my father. He said, my father is permitting, and that's why this is happening. Same thing Shankaracharya, when he came in India in the 7th century. The Indian original Vedanta had died down, and it was a very crude bunch of superstitions and false beliefs and wrong understandings. And then even the Buddhism that had been taught originally by Buddha had become so corrupted, had become so full of just dogma and rituals and meaningless, you know, exercises and renunciation, where everybody was leaving homes and becoming monks, which is what happened in Tibet, where everybody became a monk, and there were very few people to do the farming, and very few people, there were no soldiers, there was no police. So the Chinese just had to march in. They didn't have to shoot a single bullet. They took over the whole country. Why? Because everybody was a monk. There was no soldiers. There was nobody. So at that time, Shankaracharya came and told us the true meaning of Vedanta, that what is the true meaning of this ancient knowledge, and that was revived by him, this concept of that there is one consciousness everywhere which has different names. And this whole universe is an expression of that consciousness, and that consciousness is me, is not separate from me. God is not somebody up there, and God is the same in all, whether it's in plants, birds, animals, fish, even in rocks, stones, in living and inanimate objects. So the true meaning of religion, of spirituality, is what the masters taught us, and that's how the culture can be revived. So understanding the true meaning of words and correct meaning is very important. This reminds me of a little story. So there was this lady who got married, this girl, and so she goes on her honeymoon. And after a couple of weeks, comes back, you know, travels. And so she's home for 2 weeks, and then she calls her mother. She says, Mother, you need to come and take me. What? You just been married 4 weeks. No, I can't live with this man anymore. You need to come and take me right now. She said, child, tell me what's wrong. I mean, you know, he seems like a nice guy, and when you married him and you loved him and all that. And what happened in 4 weeks? No, mother, he's using horrible four-letter words. All four-letter words he's using. Four-letter words? What do you mean by, mom, their words are so horrible, I can't even repeat them. They don't even come to, and he's using them constantly, morning, afternoon, evening, and night. He's just throwing them at me. So mother says, really? Is that bad? Yeah, he's terrible. So can you please tell me what are the four-letter words? I mean, you know, at least it's okay. I know I'm your mother. So he's telling me, wash, dust, iron, cook. Wash, dust, iron, cook. He tells me that. She said, oh, mother says, he says that? Okay, I'm coming and taking you right now. How dare he do that? So the point is that the correct meaning of the words that we use is very important. What are we using, and what is the meaning? And that's what the masters taught us, that what is the correct meaning of the original teachings. And then these have been, again, by Swami Chinmayananda and other scholars have been interpreted for the modern. That's why he translated all our scriptures from Sanskrit into English and was teaching people in English to make this knowledge widely available, so that the correct meaning of the Bhagavad Gita, the Upanishads, is, and that's what, and even what is meditation, what is dhyana, and the, and all that. And in, on Sunday we do the Bhagavad Gita, where this original Sanskrit teachings have been translated into English. So the main goal that the masters told us in this life is journey to God. And it has to be a constant 24-hour-a-day effort. It cannot be a part-time job. You cannot say, I'm going to go Sunday from 10 to 11. And then reach God. It's not going to happen. It's like saying, I'm going to practice Sunday from 10 to 11 and I want to win the Olympics, or I want to climb Mount Everest, or I want to have a successful business, but I'll only go to my place of business Sunday from 10 to 11. But in the world, we are ready to put effort, but in spirituality, we find that the effort is lacking because people don't see the result. See, when I go to work, I work 40 hours, I get a paycheck at the end of on Friday. Okay, that shows I have something substantial. With that, I can buy a house, I can buy clothes, buy food, take care of my children. Same way if I, climb Mount Everest or if I go to win the Olympics, there is something substantial. Okay, you got a gold medal. But in spirituality, the results are very subtle. What is the benefit of? What am I going to get? I sit for half an hour and meditate, and then what is the end result? I listen to these scriptures, I read these books, I go to church or temple, and what am I getting out of it? Coming to this class, what is my result? Am I getting something? Am I getting a certificate? If we go to college and spend 3 years or 4 years, you get a bachelor's or you get master's. There is no certificate that you are spiritually evolved, that you have grown. So that's why the results are not very substantial. They are very subtle. But they say that your search should be continuous. There should not be a break. For example, say if I'm going from Los Angeles to New York and I'm driving and I have to get there, but I don't have a deadline that I have to be there in 3-4 days. I can be there, I can take my time. So I go from Los Angeles, I go to Denver. And then I love Denver, I love the mountains, it is the summer. So I stay for a week or two. That's okay, you stay and enjoy. But if you build a home in Denver and say, I love Denver, you'll never reach New York. Same thing, then you end up in Chicago and there is some, you have a friend you haven't met in a while. So you sit and have dinner and then you talk about old times and then he says or she says, stay here for a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, it's okay. But then you say, I love my friend, I'm going. So the point is that if your goal is New York, you may have stops along the way, but my goal is to reach New York. So after I have done, so similarly in spirituality, yes, there may be periods of time where you are not progressing towards your goal. Maybe you come to a stop. Maybe some people say, I can't meditate anymore. I have been for so many years. Now I'm bored. I'm going to take a break. But one has to remember that my goal is to know God, to reach God, and find God within as the life, the consciousness, the one that is. So just as New York, when I reach, then I realize that this was my goal and I have reached, I have become a New Yorker, I have become one with New York. So similarly, when I reach that goal of spirituality, then I become one with that. That is the meaning of Aham Brahmasmi, I am that consciousness, where then I realize that consciousness is not something outside, not something far, but is me, is my true nature. And that's why to think that God is not everywhere is foolish, because they say every atom that is moving, protons and neutrons and electrons, has to have power, has to have energy. And where does that energy come from? So everything is made of atoms, this table, this book, this, even though they appear inert, but there is constant activity. So remembering that, and that activity is me, and so whatever I'm able to talk, speak, hear, listen, do, is that expression of that divinity. So that is the essence of today's talk, that culture is our knowledge, our behavior. It is constantly changing. And following the teachings of the religious masters and understanding the meaning of culture takes me to my goal, which is knowing God or becoming one with God. So in this book, the chapter is short, but from that ideas, I got a few additional ideas, so I thought I would just share them with all. Any questions, any comments, anything any you would like to add or discuss? Yes.
Just a couple of kind of ironies or whatever. Just you know, the native indigenous people who were here were really accepting of the land here, but then, you know, the people that came from Europe came in and annihilated it. You know, but they weren't doing that. That's just kind of interesting. So that was, they're really the first Westerners, so to speak. But there was an attachment to the land, even though, even in spite of, they had harshness too. But there's pretty temperate weather, you know, if you've learned how to acclimate. It's not as harsh as it is in Europe.
Right.
And then what's interesting to me, you know, I was, you know, raised fundamental Christian. You're always taught from the East that's like satanic. But what's very interesting to me is some of the same rituals, they're identical. They're almost identical. Like, you know, there's water, you know, you see that in the liturgical Christian things where they have that here. There's the ashes. There's so many things that are so similar, and people just don't want to see it. It's just very, I find it very interesting. I think that's kind of a confirmation of the unity behind all of it. It's not as different as what we are taught to believe.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. The Mayan culture, when we went to South America and we saw the Mayan culture, it is very identical to the ancient Hindu culture. In fact, it is said, I don't know if it's true or not, but it is described that the ancient Indians were ocean seafarers, and so they came through boats to that part, and that's why it's very identical, the four castes and the four stages and the worship of the sun god and how they do it and the worship of the wind. So a lot of the chants, so a lot of the things are very identical. So you're right, the cultures are not that different.
Actually, in Mahabharata, there is a scene called Maya Sabha that was built by Mayans.
Okay.
And it was, as you said, it was all unity everywhere. People were able to travel all over the world in spite of what we believe.
Yes. In fact, one of the kings married a princess of the Mayan culture. That's described in our. So.
I know there's. I've watched some stuff on YouTube, and I really believe humans were a lot more, you know, progressive at one point, and then something happened that had to cause us to restart. So there was maybe not some of the technology we have now, but there had to be something. Like, even they know that, like Stonehenge, there's no way. You know, if, you know, so man was a lot more evolved 10,000 years ago than what we believe.
Yes, yes.
A lot more evolved, and then there was something that happened, whether, you know, I know some religions have the flood, or whether it was comets or something, you know, had to cause the world to be rebuilt.
True.
And, I mean, it was just phenomenal to me when Charter of Mal was here, and I can't remember which Upanishad we're going through, but there's actually a scripture, and it's talking about, you know, the conservation of matter and the conservation of energy right there. And I'm just like, wow, you know.
Yeah, in Cain Upanishad, there is a mention
of. That's not, it wasn't, it didn't really originate with Einstein or whoever. I don't know who came up with that part, but he kind of, he put it into the, you know, the formula of it.
True. And in the ancient texts, they did have airplanes. You know, Ram's time, Ravana actually had a plane that he could fly in, and they had all these weapons and missiles that could cause wholesale destruction. And then they had built phenomenal buildings in Mohenjo-Daro and Harappa, the ancient. These are perfect built buildings, which are like 5,000 years old, where they had drainage system, they had ditches, they had proper showers and bathroom. And absolutely scientifically built building thousands of years ago, which is amazing. And then they knew astronomy, they knew the movement of the stars, and they knew, they could predict, you know, which planet is where and when. So the science, the zero, and then a lot of the mathematics and a lot of the chemistry and medicine, even medicine, they knew cures for quite a few of the illnesses thousands of years ago, which are described in our text. So you're right, mankind was much more evolved, and then something happened to destroy that civilization, and now we are rediscovering that.
Well, it's even alluded to in the Bible, because they talk about something, the Tower of Babel, and then something happened after that, and they call it the dispersion. I mean, I think it's more of that's allegorical, not literal, but so there's some mention.
True.
That's why we find that the historian, they find lost cities, you know, they are, all of a sudden they find some of the research, that's what they do with the professor, somebody that specializes on to doing that, and how the culture, how everything vanished, and what happened.
Comet, and then volcanoes like the Pompeii, the city of all those,
volcano,
or meteors, yeah.
Or right. Disaster, maybe nature, something happened, and the whole city absolutely vanished.
Right.
You know, somewhere the ocean was, like in Greece, as in Spain, and then you find in the Middle East, I mean, you know, there's still.
Yeah, now they're able now to date stone better than they used to. And so now when they thought like the Sphinx wasn't, it's way older than they thought.
Yeah.
Right.
So it's
very interesting.
That's true.
Even under, you know, in the ocean now, they can see they were, you know, some of the cities were underneath, you know, the sun came there.
Right.
All the,
right.
All the ships, and all the World War One ship, and, you know.
True.
Find all the
trail and everything. Now, the ancient Greek, the ancient Egyptian, the ancient Chinese, they were all very advanced philosophies. Chinese medicine, I mean, they have cures for everything, and without
and
surgery.
It's unfortunate that during the Crusades that the library of Alexandria was annihilated, because that would have been interesting. But,
right.
You know, I'm of the belief that all truth is, it's marked across the universe forever, so it's always going to be accessible to someone if you're willing to seek it.
Right.
Even if it's been destroyed in the book form, it's there.
So. Right, and ultimately that one reality alone is, I think, and that one has to constantly remember that alone is, all this world is just a illusory superimposition on that reality. God is everywhere, but we don't see, because our mind is so caught up in the world of objects, emotions, and thoughts, with the body, with the mind, with the intellect. But actually everything is that divinity, and so that is what the essence of the teachings is, that see that divinity everywhere, and do not give too much meaning to the world. See, we consider the world as so important. And like last time you were asking, what will happen if this earth, you know, were to be destroyed? And we give so much meaning to me, my life, my things, my possessions. But the true meaning is in the essence of everything. And that is what we are seeking. And that is what we need to seek, because that is the ultimate goal of human birth.